welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for November the 22nd. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off with the article today, They Live and Work in Fear. Nursing homes face shortages of staffers, PPE, as COVID rages. Long-term care facilities were among those hardest hit during COVID-19's first surge this summer. Now, with the virus raging through Iowa, those facilities are once again bearing the brunt of the pandemic. So severe has the situation become that the state public health department has given its blessing as a last resort in emergency situations for long-term care workers with a confirmed COVID-19 infection to provide care to patients without the virus. As of Friday night, there were COVID-19 outbreaks, defined as three or more confirmed cases in a facility, at more than a fourth of Iowa's roughly 440 long-term care facilities. There have been nearly 1,000 deaths. Nursing homes throughout the state are facing critical shortages of available workers and personal protective equipment like gloves, protective eyewear, gowns, and medical-grade face masks. As of mid-October, 38% of Iowa nursing homes reported having less than a one-week supply of PPE, and 43% of state nursing homes reported being short on staff, according to survey responses nursing homes sent periodically to the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. While facilities across the country have been hit, Iowa is higher than the national average for nursing home resident cases and deaths per capita, and nursing home staff cases per capita, according to the federal data compiled by AARP. The state also is worse than the national average in the percentage of nursing homes that say they are short on staff and personal protective equipment for that staff. It is serious, said Dee Findley, executive director of Iowa Caregivers, a nonprofit that works to address shortages among direct care workers like certified nurse aides and home care aides. The people who work in these jobs, the nurse aides, social distancing really isn't an option. You can't give somebody a bath or assist somebody to the toilet or help them with oral hygiene from 6 feet apart. Because of that, those workers are a little higher risk of contracting and spreading the virus. So they live in fear. They love their jobs, but they still live and work in fear now. Findley said direct care workers worked in difficult conditions for years before the pandemic hit in March. There is high turnover and low pay. The median salary for direct care worker in Iowa is $13.80 per hour. They're putting their lives on the line for $13.80 per hour, Findley said. Things were not good before, so you can imagine now, in the midst of a pandemic, how challenging it is for those folks on the front line and their employers. Anthony Carroll, advocacy director for Iowa chapter of AARP, said the 38% of nursing homes with less than a one-week supply of PPE is troublingly high, particularly at the pandemic's eight-month point. We're halfway through November, and that is troubling, Carroll said. The state has a PPE stockpile, and Governor Kim Reynolds last week urged nursing homes in need to request equipment. A spokesman later clarified that a facility must be dealing with an outbreak before it can tap into the stockpile. Facilities not experiencing an outbreak will be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. Carroll said the state should do what it can to make it easier to get the PPE they need. Iowa should streamline this process to make it easier to get PPE in the hands of long-term care facility staff and residents, Carroll said. For the sake of residents, family, and staff, Iowa needs to do whatever it takes to ensure that we no longer have over 38% of Iowa nursing homes reporting that they don't have a one-week supply of PPE. On Thursday, Reynolds announced that she is dedicating $14 million in federal funding designated for COVID-19 responses efforts to help long-term care facilities with staffing and testing. When asked if the funding can also be used to purchase PPE, she referred to the state stockpile. She noted that the state has worked on the guidance for long-term care staffing. One of the new guidelines from the state public health department says workers with a confirmed COVID-19 infection may provide direct care to patients with a suspected infection as long as a last resort in emergency staffing situations, workers with a confirmed COVID-19 infection may provide direct care to patients without an infection. Reynolds said she expects to announce an initiative next week to recruit nurses and other critical care workers to come to Iowa to bolster the state's strained workforce. The governor's spokesman said details will be available this week. Like our hospitals, it's important that we also provide assistance to long-term care facilities at this time, and that every Iowan continues to do their part to protect the most vulnerable of our healthcare workforce, Reynolds said. Carroll and Findley both suggested Reynolds should consider deploying the Iowa National Guard to help with Iowa's overwhelmed healthcare workers, and both proposed a state registry for direct care workers to help employers find workers when faced with shortages. Legislation to create such a registry was proposed during the 2020 session of the legislature before the pandemic hit and derailed the session. Findley would like to see some federal pandemic response funding put toward hazard pay and address increased child care needs for direct care workers. You hear a lot about doctors and nurses, and they are very, very important, but let's not forget about those people, direct care workers, Findley said. They're on the front lines, and they are an important piece of our ability to mitigate and fight this virus, and they need our support too. Now on to the article, Pandemic Squeezes Tenants, Landlords. Even as Iowa's governor has allocated more money toward helping keep people in their homes, both homeless advocates and those relying on rent payments warn more needs to be done. Local agencies like Community Services and Friends of the Family are two of the 54 organizations across Iowa that signed onto a letter earlier this month asking Governor Kim Reynolds to allocate at least $80 million in unspent CARES Act money toward the Iowa Eviction and Foreclosure Program. About one-third of all Iowa households are rentals, and pre-COVID, 28% of Iowa renter households were extremely low income. The letter read, "And rent is now more difficult for many to pay as the state sees record increases in unemployment." Reynolds on Wednesday announced additional money for federal CARES Act dollars will go towards the state's program, but of $37.4 million allocated, only $8 million is still available to qualified renters and homeowners who apply by December 4th. The directors of both the ACLU of Iowa and the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence thanked the governor for adding funds, calling the money crucial. But directors Mark Stringer of the ACLU and Laurie Shipper of the ICADV also noted Reynolds had another $82 million in CARES Act funding to spend by the end of the year. There is more federal money that Governor Reynolds should allocate to this important safety net. "To keep people in their homes," they wrote Thursday, asking her to develop a state response next year as well, since the economic impact of COVID-19 will be felt by Iowans for months to come. Nearly 11,000 renters and 500 homeowners in Iowa have applied for assistance since the program began earlier this year, according to the governor's office. But agencies say the need is growing. "Especially now that it's holiday time, we always see a little uptick," said Lisa Ambrose, CEO of Amini. "COVID-19 and the stop-start economy it's produced are putting pressure on more people than ever before," said Ben Brustkern, executive director of Friends of the Family. "We're really starting to see a spike toward more need for housing assistance, he said. "On the other side of the equation are landlords whose livelihoods are at stake when rental income doesn't come in," said Tony Miller, executive director of the Blackhawk County Landlords, an association of property owners. "There's landlords that haven't gotten any rent since this started, and they're looking at bankruptcy," he said. "Without rental income, a landlord can't pay the mortgage on a property or do any upkeep," Miller noted. "And with a federal moratorium expiring at the end of the year, he's worried about the long-term implications. It's a horrible domino effect, and it's going to affect our economy in Blackhawk for a long time," he said. In Iowa, between 119,000 and 139,000 households were unable to pay their rent in October and were at risk of eviction, meaning a loss of rent of at least $121 million, according to a survey by Stout Resuse Ross, a global advisory firm. By November 9th, 28.5% of renters across all income categories had only slight confidence or no confidence that they could pay rent on time, according to the same survey. That's more than double the 13.5% that same October 26th. And the problem may be worse in Waterloo, which in 2016, the last year for which data were available, had the highest eviction rate in Iowa among mid-sized cities at 5.73%, according to evictionlab.org, a project maintained by Princeton University. Cedar Falls was the 18th on the list with an eviction rate of just 0.99% in 2016. Ambrose said she's optimistic funding will come through in time to help clients. Bruskern isn't so sure, but said if a safety net isn't in place to prevent homelessness, it will cause other problems like food insecurity, domestic violence, family pressures, and inadequate schooling. It's really important to have something like this so we can offset any issues occurring in the future, Bruskern said. And now let's go on to the article, Local Hospital Systems Offering Insurance. Health insurance offerings for the Cedar Valley now include options provided in partnership with both the region's hospital systems. Area residents could get an individual or family policy starting in 2021 with the tech-driven health insurance company Oscar, a new in-network provider for Mercy One hospitals in 23 Iowa counties. Or they could get a policy provided through an employer by Health Partners Unity Point Health. The insurance company started by Unity Point Health's Iowa Hospital Network in 2017 also provides Medicare Advantage products to individuals. Beginning in January, it is marketing insurance to companies with 10 to 50 employees. Previously, the insurer had only worked with larger companies. Mercy One and New York City-based Oscar recently announced their partnership for counties including Blackhawk, Bremer, Buchanan, and 20 others. Mercy One Northeast Iowa includes medical centers and other facilities in Waterloo, Cedar Falls, and Olwine. As a part of Mercy One's mission, we are working to expand healthcare for Iowans, which includes helping expand the opportunities Iowans have for insurance coverage, said Cassie Hawksmeyer, a Clive-based communications director for the medical system. Oscar and Mercy One are committed to keeping the costs of our members' care both low and affordable. The insurance provider's aim is to deliver a better experience with more savings, Mario Schlosser said. Mario Schlosser, Oscar's chief executive officer and co-founder, said in a news release. Bloomington, Minnesota-based Health Partners is also focused on helping people access high-quality, affordable care. They've been in the market in Minneapolis for over 60 years now, and Becky Woody, president of Health Partners Unity Point Health. The company saw an opportunity to replicate that model in Iowa. A joint venture was established with Unity Point Health in Des Moines to help come into the state's insurance market. Unity Point Health Allen Hospital is a part of the medical systems network along with its other Cedar Valley facilities. Christian Schaefer, Accountable Care Organization Development Specialist for the Waterloo Hospital, called the partnership a shared vision. I think it's that care and coverage, how we show it together, she explained. The insurer and medical system take a collaborative approach when we look at health not as being just the absence of disease. Health Partners Unity Point Health offers insurance products that are specific to where Unity Point Health has their facilities, said Woody. But for those individuals who may not have had access to a Unity Point Health facility, we have an open product as well. That allows for coverage to employers throughout the state, and a partnership with Cigna expands the network outside of Iowa during customers' travels. At this point, Oscar's plans can be used across Mercy One's networks in 23 Iowa counties spread all over the state. Oscar members have dedicated care teams that include a care guide, a nurse who knows their medical history, and a social worker. The company places an emphasis on remote medical care where possible and appropriate, including 24-hour daily access to Oscar virtual urgent care providers at no cost. Certain prescriptions are available at no cost through those providers as well. The patient's care needs in partnership with their provider will determine if telehealth is an option to deliver the best health outcome and experience, said Hoxmeyer. As the COVID-19 pandemic continues, access to telehealth plays an important role in helping ensure access to care. Health partners Unity Point Health provides virtual care as a way to offer more options and convenience for patients. Affordability is also important for the company. What we typically focus on through our joint venture is how we can affect the total cost of care, said Woody, while keeping people healthy. When patients do get sick, their approach is intended to recognize a disease early and support them with the best resources at the most affordable cost, she added. So if it's a collaborative effort that we bring to the market that we believe is unique and different. Open enrollment is underway with both companies, including Medicare Advantage recipients. Learn more about their insurance products online at healthpartnersunitypointhealth.com or hioscar.com. Options to sign up during open enrollment are also available at healthcare.gov. Now let's read a smaller article, Protesters Demand Stronger COVID Action. Demonstrators are demanding that Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds do more to stem the spread of the coronavirus as cases surge. More than a dozen of them gathered Friday in front of the governor's Terrace Hill mansion to deliver 800 report cards that gave her an F grade in COVID-19 mitigation and protecting Iowans. The demonstration was organized by Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, also known as Iowa CCI, the Des Moines Register reports. She has been a total failure in her inability to show leadership and to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 in the state of Iowa, said Sherry Mortis, Iowa CCI Action Fund Board President. She needs to stand up and she needs to represent the everyday needs of Iowans today. After months of opposition, Reynolds signed an order Monday that requires people to wear masks in indoor public places under some circumstances. Public health experts, however, said it contains exceptions that make it weak. The state was reporting 2,159 COVID-19-related deaths as of 10 a.m. Saturday and an increase of 32 deaths since the state's tally 24 hours earlier. The number of confirmed cases also rose by 3,627 to 206,660. Now let's go on to the article, Toilet Paper Limits, Empty Shelves Are Back. Looking for toilet paper? Good luck. A surge of new coronavirus cases in the U.S. is sending people back to stores to stockpile again, leaving shelves bare and forcing retailers to put limits on purchases. Walmart said Tuesday it's having trouble keeping up with the demand for cleaning supplies in some stores. Supermarket chains Kroger and Publix are limiting how much toilet paper and paper towels shoppers can buy after the demand spiked recently. And Amazon is sold out of most disinfectant wipes and paper towels. A similar scene played out back in March when the pandemic first hit and people are hunkered down in their homes. But Geoff Freeman, president and CEO of the Consumer Brands Association, formerly the Grocery Manufacturers Association, said he doesn't expect things to be as bad this go-around since lockdowns are being handled on a regional basis and everyone is better prepared. A more informed consumer combined with a more informed manufacturer and a more informed retailer should provide all of us with a greater sense of ease and ensure that we can all meet this growing demand, Freeman said. The biggest supply issue seems to be paper products. 21% of shelves that stock paper towels and toilet paper are empty, the highest level in at least a month, according to market research company IRI. Cleaning supplies have remained at remained level at 16%. Before the pandemic, 5 to 7% of consumer goods were typically out of stock, IRI said. Contributing to the problem is the fact that roughly 10% of the workforce at manufacturing plants where the products are being made are calling out sick, mainly because they've been in contact with others who were tested positive for COVID-19, Freeman said. Kelly Anderson of Colorado Springs, Colorado, said she needs more supplies now that in-person school in her area was canceled earlier this month and her two children are at home more. She's noticed others are stocking up too. Safeway and Walmart were nearly wiped out of bottled water and disinfectant wipes during a recent visit, both of which had been easy to find since the summer. It's also been harder to find a time to slot to get her groceries delivered. Anderson says she's had to wait as many as 2 days instead of same-day delivery. But that's still not as bad as earlier this year. March seems like a million years ago, but I do remember freaking out, she said. I couldn't get groceries delivered for a week. Walmart said while supplies are stressed in some areas, it thinks it will be able to handle any stockpiling now earlier this year. Amazon said it's working with manufacturers to get items such as disinfectant wipes, paper towels, and hand sanitizers in stock. Now on to Trump mum on vaccines. President praises US but says nothing about sharing with world. Leaders of the world's richest countries pushed for equality in the race to vaccinate people against the coronavirus, while President Donald Trump stayed quiet on sharing US-made vaccines with other nations. The battle to counter the pandemic dominated the first day of a virtual summit of group of 20 nations on Saturday, hosted by Saudi Arabia. The US president told his counterparts that any American who wants the vaccine will be able to get it, and singled out American producers, Pfizer Inc., whose lab has been developing along with a German company, and Moderna Inc. According to officials who asked not to be named discussing the talks, which weren't open to the press. Trump praised American leadership, claiming credit for what he said was an efficient fight against the virus and success in bolstering the nation's economy. But he said nothing about granting access to American vaccines by the rest of the world. U.S. coronavirus deaths continue to soar, having recently passed 250,000, with the nation repeatedly reaching a record for daily cases. Total infections are nearly 12 million, with states including Ohio and California posting new COVID-19 case highs. Shortly after Trump remarked that he left the virtual session, while UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson was speaking, and was replaced by Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, and then the White House Economic Advisor Larry Kudlow, according to officials familiar with the meeting. Trump later departed the White House for his Virginia golf course. The White House didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. Russia in August trumpeted its success in becoming the first nation to register a COVID-19 vaccine. Sputnik V, US and European rivals, though, are now moving faster to produce their vaccines and obtain regulatory approval. The European Union has reached a deal with Pfizer, which is partnered with Germany's BioNTech SE, and is negotiating an accord with Moderna. China, meanwhile, is already rolling out mass vaccine output to fight the disease, offering it as a tool of soft power. Echoing Trump, Brazilian President E.R. Bolsonaro said it was up to each individual to decide whether to be vaccinated, adding that the pandemic shouldn't justify attacks on people's freedom. Russian President Vladimir Putin said his country is ready to share its vaccine with others that need it. That's even as Russia hadn't produced enough to start mass inoculation of its own population. It is a case when competition may be inevitable, but we must proceed primarily with humanitarian considerations and make it a priority, Putin added about vaccine availability, according to an official Kremlin translation of his remarks. China, likewise, made a point of offering up its vaccines. China will honor its pledge, provide help and support to developing countries, and strive to make vaccines a global public good that is accessible and affordable to all countries. President Xi Jinping told the meeting, according to state broadcaster CCTV. Now let's go on to the article, Judge Denies Trump Campaign Bid. Certification allowed in Pennsylvania, obstruction of Wisconsin recount alleged. Pennsylvania officials can certify election results that are currently show President-elect Joe Biden winning the state by more than 80,000 votes, a federal judge ruled Saturday, dealing President Donald Trump's campaign another blow in its efforts to invalidate the election. U.S. District Judge Matthew Bran in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, turned down the request for an injunction by President Donald Trump's campaign, spoiling the incumbent's hopes of somehow overturning the results of the presidential contest. In his ruling, Brand said the Trump's campaign presented strained legal arguments without merit and speculative accusations unsupported by evidence. In the United States of America, this cannot justify the disenfranchisement of a single voter, let alone all the voters, of its sixth most populated state, the opinion said. Our people, laws, and institutions demand more. Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, and campaign senior legal advisor, Jenna Ellis, pointed to the decision as a positive development in their effort to push the case relatively quickly to the U.S. Supreme Court. In a joint statement, they said they would seek an expedited appeal to the U.S. Third Circuit Court of Appeals. Trump had argued that the U.S. Constitution guarantee of equal protection under the law was violated when Pennsylvania counties took different approaches to notifying voters before an election about technical problems with their submitted mail-in ballots. Pennsylvania Secretary of State Kathy Brookvar and the seven Biden-majority counties that the campaign sued had argued Trump had previously raised similar claims and lost. They told Brand the remedy that Trump campaign sought to throw out millions of votes over alleged isolated issues was far too extreme, particularly after most of them had been tallied. There is no justification on any level for the radical disenfranchisement they seek, Brookvar's lawyers wrote in a brief filed Tuesday. The state's 20 election votes would not have been enough on their own to hand Trump a second term. Counties must certify their results to Brookvar by Monday, after which she will make her own certification. Democratic Governor Tom Wolf will notify the winning candidate's electors they should appear to vote in the Capitol on December 14th. Meanwhile, election officials in Wisconsin's largest county accused observer for Trump on Saturday of seeking to obstruct a recount of the presidential results, in some instances by objecting to every ballot tabulators pulled to count. Trump requested the recount in Milwaukee and Dane counties, both heavily liberal, in hopes of undoing Biden's victory by about 20,600 votes, with no precedent for a recount reversing such a large margin. Trump's strategy is widely seen as aimed at an eventual court challenge, part of a push in key states to undo his election loss. Also Saturday, Trump's legal team said that his campaign has requested a recount of votes in the Georgia presidential race after results showed Biden winning. Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger on Friday certified the state's election results, which had Biden beating Trump by 12,670 votes out of about 500 million out of about 5 million cast, or 0.25% about 0.25%. Republican Governor Brian Kemp then certified the state's slate of 16 presidential electors. Now let's go on to the article, UK leader to end England's national lockdown. Cases over 12 million in US, Johnson to lift action on December 2nd. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson plans to end an England-wide lockdown as scheduled on December 2nd, and to announce a return to regional restrictions as statistics show coronavirus infections have stabilized. And more than 12 million people in the United States have contracted the coronavirus since the start of the pandemic. The national total numbers of confirmed cases reached 12.01 million on Saturday, 6 days after the number had reached 11 million, according to a tally by Johns Hopkins University. Johnson's office said late Saturday that the government planned to return to using a three-tiered system of localized restrictions in England, with areas facing different measures and based on the severity of their outbreaks. The government put England under a four-week lockdown that started on November 5th. The cabinet is scheduled to discuss the plans Sunday, and the Prime Minister is aiming to give Parliament the details on Monday, according to the statement. Johnson's office also confirmed plans to begin a nationwide COVID-19 vaccination program next month, assuming regulators approve a vaccine against the virus. New known cases of COVID-19 have started to drop across the UK, with the number of positive tests during the past 7 days falling 13.8% from the week before. Meanwhile, California enacted a curfew starting Saturday night in an attempt to keep people away from parties, social mixing, and drinking, the kind of activities blamed for causing infections to soar. The state's curfew will run from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. curfew for most of the state's residents and the last through at least December 21st. U.S. health officials Saturday agreed to allow emergency use of a second antibody drug to help the immune system fight COVID-19, an experimental medicine that President Donald Trump was given when he was sickened last month. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for November the 22nd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Donna M. Storey. Donna M. Storey, 72, of Waterloo, died Tuesday, November 17th at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital of complications of COVID. She was born February 28, 1948 in Waterloo, daughter of Donald F. and Margaret M. Krumpholz Storey. Donna spent most of her working life in the food and beverage profession, holding positions at Pod's Tap, Vernie's Lounge, and others. She also worked in food service at IBP. She loved going to bingo, doing word puzzles, and baking with her sister Judy. Survivors include two brothers, Jim Storey and Jerry Storey, both of Waterloo, nieces and nephews, Jason Storey of St. Louis, Missouri, Jennifer O'Sesterly, Bill Storey, and Nicole Ruth, all of Waterloo, and nine great-nieces and nephews, Isabel, Jacob, Brenine, Court, Chase, Cameron, Brittany, Kaylee, and Tira. A private graveside interment will be held at Garden of Memories Cemetery, Hagarty Wachoff Garup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway, in assisting the family. Condolences may be left with www.hagartywachoffgarup.com. Jerome Jerry Morsehammer, 78, of Cedar Falls, passed away at Cedar Valley Hospice Home on Monday, November 16, 2020. He was born September 23, 1942, in Lac Qui Parle, Minnesota, son of Joseph and Ragna Hammer. Jerry married his high school sweetheart, Anita Dervston, my apologies for any mispronunciations, on May 18, 1963, in Bremerton, Wisconsin. After serving in the U.S. Navy, the couple moved to Cedar Falls, where he worked for John Deere until his retirement in 2015. Anita preceded him in death in 1993. Jerry was married to Nancy Kawelty on September 29, 1994, at Nazareth Lutheran in Cedar Falls. Jerry was preceded in death by his parents, his first wife Anita, and a brother, Roland. He is survived by his wife of 26 years, Nancy, his sons, Brian Hammer of Dunkerton and Mike Hammer, his daughter, Julie Barth of Cedar Falls, stepsons, Ryan Kowalty of Cedar Falls and Chris Kowalty of Keller, Texas, 3 grandchildren, 6 step-grandchildren, 2 great-grandchildren, and a sister, Adeline Johnson of St. Paul, Minnesota. Due to COVID-19, Jerry's family has held a private funeral service with burial at Greenwood Cemetery of Cedar Falls at this time. Condolences may be left at www.dahlfuneralhome.com, and in lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Cedar Valley Hospice or to the family. Jerry was a huge fan of the Minnesota Vikings. He loved doing jigsaw puzzles, gardening, landscaping, and feeding the birds. Above all, Jerry cherished time with his family, especially his grandkids and great-grandkids. Audrey Lane Hartman. Audrey Lane Hartman departed our world on November 18, 2020. She lived her best life for 80 years. She was known as Lane to all who knew and loved her. Lane was born in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, to Gerald and Evelyn Person, and spent her childhood in Wisconsin and Iowa. She was married to Ken Hartman for 59 years until his death in 2017. They had a home in Plainfield, Iowa, where they raised their 5 children. Lane was an extremely talented fiber artist. She mastered many of the needle arts, including but not limited to knitting, embroidery, beading, needlepoint, sewing, and quilting. Weaving was another passion of Lane's, and her work found its way into homes, religious centers, and museums in the Midwest and Eastern United States. Lane especially loved color and was an expert at using it in her work. The Plainfield Public Library was very important to Lane. She enjoyed participating in events there and supporting it however she could. She had many friends in the area, and her family is very grateful to them for the love and support they gave Lane over the years. Lane was preceded in death by Kenneth Hartman, Gerald Person, Adrienne Person, Merle Connor, Robert Person, and Kenneth Brandt Hartman. Lane is survived by her mother, Evelyn Person, sisters Candice Lookit and Martha Plannert, children Suzanne Kelly, married to David Kelly of St. Cloud, Minnesota, Stephanie Hartman of Minneapolis, Theodore Hartman of Sioux Falls, and Kelly Hartman of Philadelphia, Megan Kelly, granddaughter, and Neil Kelly, grandson. Lane's family would like to extend their gratitude for the care that was received at Bartles Lutheran Retirement Community, as well as from the nurses from Unity Point Hospice. Private graveside services will be held at a later date in Willow Lawn Cemetery in Plainfield. Memorials can be made to the Plainfield Public Library, and online condolences for Lane can be left at www.kaisercorson.com. Kaiser Corson Funeral Home of Waverly is assisting the Hartman family with arrangements, and their phone number is 319-352-1187. Now let's move on to some other articles. Let's start with Pardon Me. Iowa turkeys will receive presidential reprieve. 2 turkeys from a Walcott Farms presidential flock are headed to Washington, D.C. to be pardoned by President Donald Trump. Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig stopped Friday at the farm of Ron and Susie Cardle to help send off 2 toms for the president's review and pardoning on Tuesday. The Walcott family is the 8th from Iowa to raise the turkeys for the annual pardoning, the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship tweeted. The first presidential turkey proclamation event was held in 1947 when President Harry Truman received a live turkey from the National Turkey Federation, according to the Iowa Department of Agriculture. And pardoning as a custom began with President George H.W. Bush in 1989. One of the birds will be named the official Thanksgiving turkey, and others will serve as an alternate, according to an Iowa State University news release. Both will then live out their days at Iowa State, where animal science students, faculty, and College of Veterinary Medicine students will contribute to their care and will be available for public viewing starting at 10 a.m. December 5th. Individuals can also follow along with their journey to the White House on the National Turkey Federation Facebook page. The turkeys will make their way to D.C. this week via van for a stay in the Willard Hotel before visiting the White House. "They've kind of been pampered," Ron Cardle said. "We built a 10-by-24-foot building with ventilation, heating, air conditioning, and a little patio outside for the presidential flock of 30 turkeys from which the two toms were chosen. The turkeys hatched in early July and have been gobbling along to oldies tunes to help them get used to crowd noises," according to the National Turkey Federation. A sixth-generation turkey and row crop farmer, Ron Cardle, serves as the current chairman of the National Turkey Federation and is responsible for the supplying of a turkey for the annual National Thanksgiving Turkey presentation. Cardle said having his turkey selected as this year's National Presidential Turkeys is an honor he relishes in an otherwise tough year for the turkey industry. "Especially in 2020, it's kind of nice to have something good happening, and it's a feel-good celebration," Cardle said. "It's been a rough year for lots of industries for lots of different reasons, and it's nice to have a feel-good story." The COVID-19 pandemic lopped off a large portion of the industry's market as restaurants closed their doors, said Cardle, who also serves as vice chairman of West Liberty Foods, which supplies sliced turkey to Subway sandwich shops and other restaurants and grocery chains. It was huge implications for us, and the irony was that we had too much meat and the people in the food lines, and nobody likes to see that," Cardle said. "With help from some relaxed labeling laws, we were able to divert from one stream into a different stream to keep America fed, shifting some production to retail packaging. As a result, growers have temporarily paused their flocks this fall to allow the company to clear its freezers," Cardle said. The Iowa Farm Bureau Federation 35th Annual Thanksgiving Survey, released Friday, shows the cost of a turkey at roughly $1.21 per pound. It is the lowest price since 2010. "Our livestock and poultry farmers still face the challenge of recovering from the lost markets and the supply chains impacted by COVID. But that hasn't stopped them from producing sustainably grown real meat products we enjoy at Thanksgiving," Sam Funk, IFBF Director of Agriculture Analytics and Research, said in a press release. Iowa ranks 7th in the nation in turkey production, with 130 turkey farmers, in the 5th largest state for turkey processing. The turkey industry generates $10.64 billion in total economic activity throughout Iowa, according to the Iowa State University. Now let's move on to some sports articles. College football. Hawkeyes send Nittany Lions to 0-5. When Sean Clifford came off the bench to bring a little spark into a struggling Penn State football team, Chauncey Golston and Davion Nixon showed up with extinguishers. The two Iowa defensive linemen wrapped their arms around Nittany Lions' passes in the fourth quarter Saturday, helping Coach Kirk Fertinez reach a milestone as Hawkeyes celebrated a 41-21 victory at Beaver Stadium that left Penn State 0-5 for the first time in 134 seasons of football. Nixon, who tipped a pass to Goldston to thwart a drive in a 10-point game with 9 minutes 42 seconds remaining, added the exclamation point by returning an interception 71 yards for a touchdown with 1 minute and 58 seconds left to play. The win, Iowa's first in its last 7 tries against the Nittany Lions, made Fertinez just the 4th coach in Big Ten history to earn 100 conference victories. "Things were starting to get a little too interesting. We miss a field goal. Guy comes in and gets 2 quick scores. All those things start to run through the mind. Is this going to be one of those stories? But the guys found a way to get it done," Fertinez said. The defensive line stepped up and made a difference. The front four, those guys played really well. Iowa's line play on both sides of the ball initially helped the Hawkeyes seize control of a game Penn State led 7-3 after one quarter. The Hawkeyes scored 21 points in the second quarter and added 7 more on a 3-yard quarterback sneak by quarterback Spencer Petras to open a 31-7 lead just past the midpoint of the third quarter. Sean Clifford, replaced as Penn State's starting quarterback, came off the bench minutes later and delivered a couple of quick scores that made Iowa pay for its mistakes. On the first snap, Clifford took after a Petrez fumble, put the ball in Nittany Lions' hands with 4 minutes and 9 seconds to go in the third. He hit Brenton Strange with a 28-yard touchdown pass. Iowa's next possession ended with a missed 50-yard field goal try, and Clifford repeated his initial feat, hitting Jahan Dulston with a 68-yard scoring pass over the middle to cut the Iowa lead to 31-21, with 7 seconds left to go in the third quarter. The Hawkeyes had to punt the ensuing possession, but Golston put down a jump ball that Nixon had tipped to give the ball back to the Iowa. 6 plays later, Duncan hit a 24-yard field goal to extend Iowa's lead to 34-21 with 7 minutes and 14 seconds remaining. The teams traded punts before the 6'3", 305-pound Nixon collected the Nittany Lions' 4th turnover of the game. Jumping in front of a Clifford pass and rumbling it with it 71 yards for the first touchdown, he said his second at any level of football. The first touchdown he scored at any level of football. My first mindset was to run through the quarterback, but I saw the right tackle was close, and I thought I've got to go score. Nixon said. It didn't surprise teammates that Nixon reached the end zone. Nick Nealman, whose 17 tackles were the most collected by a Hawkeye since Anthony Hitchens had 19 against Iowa State in 2012, called Nixon one of the better athletes on the Iowa team. "I'm just happy he made it," Nealman said. "He's one of those guys who's always had a nose for the ball." The Hawkeyes demonstrated that as a group on their way to a third straight win, limiting Penn State 62 rushing yards and having 10 players contribute to a collection of 10 tackles for a loss that included 5 sacks of Clifford and the starter he replaced, Will Levis. "It was just everyone trying to get the ball," Nieman said. Penn State fumbled the ball twice, as well as defensive Zach Von Valkenburg recovered both. He first came after Iowa erased the 7-3 advantage the Nittany Lions had taken with 2 minutes and 12 seconds left in the opening quarter on a 6-yard touchdown run by Kevon Lee. Iowa answered the ensuing series opening a 21-point second quarter with a 10-yard touchdown run by Tyler Goodson that put the Hawkeyes in front to stay with 14 minutes and 35 seconds left in the second quarter. McKee Sargent, who totaled 101 of Iowa's 175 rushing yards, scored on a pair of 1-yard runs later in the quarter to send the Hawkeyes into the locker room with a 24-7 lead at the break. Sargent's second score came after a Jack Heflin sack slowed a drive and left Penn State in a 4th-and-2 situation in the final minute of the half. The Nittany Lions went for the first down, but an incomplete pass put the ball in Iowa's hands at the Penn State 49-yard line with 53 seconds to go. Petras, who completed 18 of 28 passes for 186 yards, connected on 4 straight to move the ball to the 1, where after an incompletion, Sargent scored with 7 seconds left in the quarter. "We had all 3 timeouts, the guys made a couple of plays, and we got the touchdown," Petras said. It was a good way to end the half. And now on to the article, College Football, Number 17 Cyclones Trounce Wildcats to Improve to 6-2. Iowa State and Kansas State traditionally play games that end with margins that are within one score. That didn't happen on Saturday at Jack Trice Stadium. Number 17 Iowa State pummeled Kansas State 45-0 and improved to 6-2 overall and 6-1 in the Big 12 to maintain its Big 12 leading pace. A lot of positive things happened for the Cyclones against the Wildcats. So many, in fact, that Coach Matt Campbell used the word 12 times in the first 8 questions that were asked to him during his post-game press conference. But it wasn't perfect. "We took a positive step," Campbell said. "All good football teams want to take a positive step in November. We've played 2 games in November, and I've seen a lot of really positive growth in those games. I think a real challenge for football teams this time of year is, can you get better? I think you see us improving, and that part is really big for our football team. The real challenge is, can you continue to do those things? We'll find out a lot about ourselves as we continue on this journey. It's something the team has bought into. All of the players that were made available to the media after the game, Xavier Hutchinson, Breece Hall, Sean Forrester, and Greg Eisworth, all acknowledged how well the team played, but they all mentioned the mindset the team has to keep improving. I think it was the best game we've played, Hutchinson said. I think that was probably the best we've played, and the great part is, I think we can still play a lot better. We still have a lot more room for growth, and I'm excited for us to reach that full potential. It makes one wonder what the full potential looks like. On Saturday, quarterback Brock Purdy and running back Breece Hall had no problems carving up Kansas State's defense. Purdy played 3 quarters and was 16 for 20 with 236 yards and 3 touchdowns. He also rushed 7 times for 59 yards. Hutchinson had a first half to remember. The junior had 5 catches for 103 yards and a touchdown. He ended with 6 catches for 111 yards and a touchdown. Hall also played just 3 quarters and rushed the ball 15 times for 135 yards and 2 touchdowns. Defensively, Mike Rose was dominant once again. The junior linebacker had 7 tackles, 2.5 tackles for a loss, a sack, and an interception. Defensive end Will McDonald also gave Kansas State's offensive line fits all night. He had 4 tackles, 2.5 tackles for a loss, a sack, and 2 forced fumbles. Iowa State outgained Kansas State 539 yards to 149 yards. The only time Kansas State even threatened to score was in its first drive of the game. The Wildcats drove right down the field but couldn't convert on a 4th-and-goal from the 2-yard line. Since that 62-yard opening drive, Kansas State gained just 87 yards the rest of the game. Iowa State forced 3 turnovers, Rose's interception and the 2 fumbles, and 2 turnovers on downs. But the team still sees more out there. I think that demand would be there even if we didn't have a win, Eisworth said. I feel like it's pointless to do something if you're not going to do it to the best of your ability. The scoreboard is what it is, but the question we ask ourselves is, did we reach our full potential? Right now, the team's answer is a resounding no, but it's one thing to say you haven't peaked and another to prove that you haven't peaked. I think for me, it's not about offense and defense, Campbell said. I think we're playing great football and we're playing as one team. And you saw that again tonight in a lot of the football game. It's the defense getting the ball back for the offense. The offense is effectively moving the football. It's playing together, and that part is what good football teams do. We're not just offense, we're not just defense. We're a team that's what we strive to be. So I think in general, you're seeing us getting better playing the sport of football and playing team football along the way. And for that, I'm really proud of our guys' growth. We will have to continue to grow because those things will only get harder and more challenging. Now let's go on to a more local sports article, Go Hawks Ready to Fly. Bradley Commit Draper will be one of the top players in the state. Greg Bodensteiner is not going to fret about what he doesn't have. Fresh off back-to-back Class 4A state basketball appearances, Bodensteiner's Waverly Shell Rock team is primed to be one of the better teams in Northeast Iowa again this winter. For one, the Gohawks have one of the top players in the state in 6'1" wing and Bradley Commit, Abby Draper. Abby is a really good player, Bodensteiner said. She can handle the ball, and she could score off the dribble, and she is a 40% shooter from three-point range. It is not going to be a secret. The stuff we are going to do will be centered around giving her opportunities to work in the space. The challenge is to keep our opponents from having many defenders around her. The complementary pieces surrounding Draper is the biggest question mark for the Gohawks. WSR graduated 2 key players in Brittany Young and Cameron Grayway. Then, in the off-season, 6-foot post Morgan suffered an ACL injury and will miss the entire 2020-21 season. Another returning starter, Kenzie Rowling, has signed to play soccer at Iowa and is not going to play basketball this winter. Those are a couple of pieces we were hoping to have, but it just didn't work out, Bodensteiner said. We have enough pieces back, however, that we are going to be able to put a really good competitive team out there. We are in the process of figuring out which kids fit in with the kids we are already know a lot about and are trying to figure out what we can do the best and how to put the best possible team on the court we can. The first place Bodensteiner will look is other returning players. Annika Bernards is a returning starter, and although not blessed with great height, is a force inside the paint. She is a state champion in wrestling and started half of our games for us, Bodensteiner said. Although she is only 5'6", she finds more rebounds than the average player. She brings us a toughness factor to the post, although she is undersized. Sasha Wilson, Trinity Moore, and Macy Smith all played substantial minutes last winter for WSR. Senior Emma Hansel is also in the mix for increased minutes. Then there is a roster full of junior varsity players who went undefeated, as well as sophomore post Ellie Thompson. We have a bunch of younger kids that we know are capable, Bodensteiner said. We also have a nice freshman group coming in with a couple kids in the 5'10" to 6-foot range that we've got to familiarize them with our stuff and see if they can help us down the stretch. We're just trying to sort out which ones fit into the group and how they complement our team the best. It's just a matter of how that shakes out and what order we are going to play those kids in and what things will look like when we play our first game. We've always played games earlier, but this year we don't play until December 1st, so we have some time to sort that out. Bodensteiner has also built a schedule to test the Gohawks. WSR opens with talented Western Dubuque squad on December 1st, travels to Center Point Urbana on December 12th to face a team that has played in 6 of the last 7 state tournaments and plays at Mason City and Cedar Rapids Prairie. We've tried to make our schedule as challenging as we could, Bodensteiner said. We've tried to do everything that we can to put ourselves in as many difficult situations as possible, knowing that they may result in some extra losses during the season. But it will make us a better team by the end of the year. There is no question that we have the ability to be a really good basketball team. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for November the 22nd. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.